Chapter 3. The Age of Acrodynia. We would say the essential element present was some degree of emotional deprivation associated with the child's being unwanted. A psychiatric study of 6 cases of infantile acrodynia. 1952. The ripple effects of mercury in medicine go far beyond the diseases we've described thus far. General paralysis of the insane and hysteria have common roots in mercury poisoning, but who knows how many deaths and other disorders have gone unrecorded and under the guise of treatment. Mercuric chloride is the particular form of mercury that comes up in GPI and hysteria through the vehicles of Van Sweeten's liquor and antiseptics. But even a cursory review of chemotherapy in medicine reveals that mercury use took an extraordinarily wide range of forms. Pick up any 19th-century catalog of medicines, and the section on mercury will be lengthy. Mercury in pills, powders, and rubs, along with a recommended set of uses for every ailment under the sun. Mercuric chloride was among the more common formulations, but perhaps the most widely used form of mercury was its cousin, mercurous chloride, otherwise known as calomel. The difference between the two may seem slight in both name and chemical formulation. Mercuric chloride, also known as mercury bichloride or corrosive sublimate, is a single mercury atom bound to 2 chlorine atoms, designated HgCl2. Mercurous chloride is HgCl2. Meaning that each molecule has 2 mercury atoms bound to each other, and each bound in turn to a chlorine atom. Calomel was less toxic than its chemical cousin and more widely used by doctors for a range of problems. Doctors prescribed calomel for infants to help regulate their bowels and soften the gums during infancy in formulations marketed as teething powders. This practice led to an ailment called acrodynia, an episode of medical malpractice that sickened thousands of children. Many died. The history of acrodynia is now told as a heroic triumph of medical technology, and there is truth to this part of the story. But the age of acrodynia also shines a light on a range of other practices that characterize the medical industry. These practices, including direct-to-consumer advertising, lack of precaution with toxic formulations, and an eagerness to intervene, even in the earliest months of life, remain object lessons to this day. The medical industry promotes itself as a bastion of rigorous scientific objectivity, but the need for medical science often runs into conflict with the commercial imperatives of practicing entities, drug manufacturers, medical doctors, and the professional communities that set the standards of care. The heroic impulse to do something has more often embodied superstition and just plain bad medicine than the medical industry would care to admit. The folklore that can accumulate over many years has remarkable staying power, even when it's wrong. It's rare when insiders are courageous enough to call attention to these superstitions. One who did so was Leo Kanner, who, before he moved to the United States to study GPI and later take on Freud, started his career fascinated by superstitious beliefs that surrounded human teeth. The Literary Bureau for Dentists. Leo Kanner was born Haskell Lieb Kanner in the small town of Klekotov, at the easternmost tip of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, almost a stone throw from the Russian border. As he wrote in his unpublished autobiography, Kanner's nationality has generally been reported as Austrian, but the area was known in Kanner's time as Galicia, and today, Kanner's birthplace lies in the sovereign nation of Ukraine. He grew up there, and in a nearby community of Jews, called Brody. Before long, he moved to Berlin, where he began medical studies, which he left in order to serve with the German army as a medical officer in World War I. After the war, Kanner settled back in Berlin to finish his degree and start a medical practice in the turbulent post-war Weimar Republic, which was beset from the beginning by social upheaval and staggering inflation. Still, he was resourceful and found a way to augment his income. A government decree had offered dentists the chance to use the honorific doctor if they wrote a thesis after graduating from dental school. Suddenly, 20,000 dentists from Vienna to Sarajevo were scrambling for original thesis topics. To one such acquaintance, Kanner suggested writing about superstitions and practices involving teeth among the peasants in the man's homeland of East Prussia. The suggestion seemed to strike a chord, and word quickly spread that Kanner was a fountain of ideas. Soon, dentists were besieging him for topics and commissioning him to prepare bibliographies and abstracts. He and a friend opened a literary bureau for dentists in Kanner's small Berlin apartment. His wife, June, served as typist and wrote most of the abstracts. Kanner was also teaching part-time in the medical school. Substituting for another professor one day, he struck up a friendship with Dr. Louis Holtz of Aberdeen, South Dakota, who was on a study tour of Europe to distract himself from the recent death of his wife. One day, Holtz brought Kanner with him to the American consulate, saying he needed to deal with some small matter. Holtz disappeared into another room and emerged with a document for Kanner to sign. Holtz was pledging to sponsor the Kanners should they decide to emigrate from Berlin to America. Although Kanner had no particular intention of moving, he signed the document, and just 2 weeks later, Holtz told Kanner he had found him a job at the Yankton State Hospital in South Dakota. The superintendent, George Adams, was a friend of Holtz's. In his autobiography, Kanner does not mention wrestling with this decision that would uproot his entire life. Perhaps, combined with the endless specter of runaway inflation, Holtz made it so easy that it seemed almost inevitable. On January 30, 1924, the Kanners, with their son Albert, left Berlin by train, took a boat across the channel to England, and boarded a vessel for New York City. In his autobiography, Kanner describes the voyage as serene and tranquil. But back in Germany, such tranquility was not on the horizon. Adolf Hitler was about to go on trial for the Beer Hall Putsch. During the resulting prison sentence, he wrote Mein Kampf and emerged a year later as a national force. Just a few years after that, Hitler's hatred would spill over into the Shtetls. 15,000 people, nearly the entire population, were murdered in Brody alone. For Leo Kanner, serendipity had struck. The death of a doctor's wife in Aberdeen, South Dakota, spared Kanner from the Holocaust and put him on track to the top of his profession. In Yankton, between poker games and learning to drive a Chevrolet, Kanner pursued his academic interests in medicine. His dental thesis sideline in Berlin had left him with piles of research that he explored with growing fascination. Taking a cue from his first suggestion for a dental thesis, he decided to put all the pieces together and write a book, Folklore of the Teeth. This was a global anthropology of teeth, an in-depth analysis of cultural practices and superstitions all over the world. One remarkable aspect of Kanner's account is the detailed description of cultural practices with respect to infant teeth. The technical term is dentition. Today, we accept infant teething as a natural and trivial event, but for much of human history it was considered a passage of great importance. Kanner wrote, "Dentition, according to the general belief, being one of the most important and also most dangerous processes in the life of an individual, it is easily understood that very great attention is paid by the baby's relatives to the eruption of the first deciduous tooth. Almost everywhere, the mother or the father inspects the child's mouth very carefully each day to see if the eagerly expected little white spot has found its way through the gums." This heightened focus on dentition was not merely a charming old custom. whereas today the happy arrival of the tooth fairy during the night is all that remains of the mystical dimension of teething. The focus through most of recorded history was laden with anxiety and sometimes downright dread. Nothing expresses the popular fear of dentition as well as the Spanish proverb, "When the child cuts its teeth, death is on the watch." The Maronites of Mount Lebanon say, "If my mother only knew when my first teeth will come through, she would prepare a shroud for me." Therefore, nothing should be omitted that, in the people's opinion, might help the child live through that perilous period safely. No expenses should be shunned. There exists a German adage that says, when the child cuts its teeth, the mother should sell her skirt and buy wine for the baby. Kanner notes how concern for first dentition cut across cultures that had no contact with one another. Why that should be is hard to discern, but it might be a temporal association. Maternal antibodies against diseases are passed to the infant through breastfeeding. When a child is weaned, those antibodies wane, and he or she becomes susceptible to serious, sometimes fatal, childhood illnesses. That is also about the time of first dentition. However, the fears arose. Treatments inevitably evolved to ward off trouble. Kanner wrote about these treatments at some length. There were many approaches. Topical. One very common method consists in rubbing the baby's gums, making use of different materials. In ancient Greece, either butter or honey was used for this purpose, or the brain of a hare. In Rome, hare's brain or sheep's brain, or goat's milk. And in a modern context, they were downright odd. In some of those regions, the hare's brain is also eaten by the child. The German inhabitants of Switzerland cut off the paws of a toad or of a water rat, and rub with these the child's gums, both outside and inside. Then they hang the paws around its neck. Another cross-cultural belief had a longer life, that keeping the child regular in its bowel habits could aid in teething. Again, exactly how these two very separate activities became conflated is uncertain, but it certainly led to strange practices. Almost everywhere we find the opinion that the bad complications of dentition could be kept away by keeping the bowels open. For this reason, the Slovaks hated to check, prevent, diarrhea occurring in children at their teething age. If they do so, the babies will have difficulty in cutting their teeth. In Dalmatia, the little ones are given castor oil and enemata to facilitate dentition. To Kanner, a secular modernist, exposing these antiquated beliefs was part of putting them firmly in the past, where they belonged. In the opening words of Folklore of the Teeth, Kanner declared himself a thoroughly modern medical man. It has been one of the noblest endeavors of scientific progress of recent days to discredit superstition, to free the human mind from the oppressing clasp of mystical fears and apprehensions, to liberate the atmosphere from the fancied presence of spirits and ghosts, of demons and devils, projected into existence by the highly creative imagination of our bewildered ancestors. Writing in the 1920s, Kanner had reason for optimism, but he overstated the degree of progress in banishing superstition, a specter he was to grapple with later when he challenged Freud. Before taking on Freud, however, he had begun taking note of odd beliefs in his colleagues. He found another exemplar of weird science in his new boss, G.S. Adams, the Yankton superintendent. Kanner liked Adams, but was bemused by his beliefs, particularly his adherence to the theory of focal infections, which ascribed all psychiatric troubles to the effect of bacteria lodged in some part of the body. Patients were treated by having their teeth, tonsils, gallbladders, and appendices removed. A Chicago surgeon, Bayard Holmes, went about the country resecting parts of colons with the conviction that this would cure schizophrenia, and with no other results than that, as Dr. Adolf Meyer punned, colons were changed to semicolons. What Kanner didn't know was that medical superstition was at that very moment proving more dangerous than any folkloric practice he had ever taken pains to criticize. Bad medicine. The connection between medicine and superstition is more pervasive than we often think. Ancient medical practices often involved witch doctors and shamans performing theatrical rituals that affected the mind of the patient as much as anything else. Most medical historians credit the Greeks with the transition away from superstition as a basis for medical treatment. But the rationality of the sort Kanner aspired to promote is more elusive than most of us recognize, and took longer to develop. To be sure, a cumulative understanding of human anatomy and biology has grown over the centuries since the ancient Greeks. But even as a body of knowledge developed, the reasons people became sick remained completely obscure, and as a result, the medical treatments that prevailed through much of human history remained correspondingly counterproductive. No one captures the hidden history of medical malpractice as much as David Wooten in Bad Medicine, Doctors Doing Harm Since Hippocrates. "I'm all in favor of good medicine," Wooten writes, "but the subject of good medicine is inseparable from the subject of bad medicine. And of the two subjects, bad medicine is by far the less explored, and by far the larger." In fact, he argues that before Lister applied Pasteur's germ theory to surgery in 1865, all medicine was bad medicine. That is to say, it did far more harm than good. Underlying Wooten's critique is the dirty little secret of the Western medical tradition. The medical treatments that the Greeks pioneered and that European doctors followed for centuries after the Renaissance were guided by a biological paradigm that now seems as magical and superstitious as the incantations of witch doctors. The theory of humors. Humoral medicine was based on the four supposed properties of the body that, in proper balance, defined health. Out of balance, they were the source of disease. Though there were just four humors, blood, black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm, their unsteady interaction yielded endless permutations and numerous possibilities for unhealthy mischief based on adverse combinations. Medical ideas based on the humors go as far back as ancient Egypt, but Hippocrates systemized them in the 4th century BC, and Galen popularized them a few hundred years later. This dubious march of diagnostic progress reached its next major milestone with Paracelsus in the 16th century AD. Often called the founder of modern pharmacology, he was the first to propose specific chemical remedies based on his superior diagnoses of precise imbalances underlying specific illnesses. Even today, despite his almost comically bizarre theorizing, Paracelsus is sometimes credited with advancing the progress of medical thinking. But even a cursory review of Paracelsus's writings shows that his theories were more magical than Galen's, stirring astrology, religiosity, and alchemy into a witch's brew lacking only paw of toad. Regarding these questionable advances in medicine, Wooten uses an apt analogy, namely, the distinction between medieval astrology and modern astronomy. Did the insights and revelations of Galileo and Copernicus, Einstein and Hawking simply update the astrological worldview? No, they relegated its practitioners to a corner of the comics pages. With medicine, in contrast, Wooten points out that there was an almost willful determination to pretend that modern medicine was a natural development from Hippocratic medicine, that Hippocrates could still be the doctor's daily companion. A present-day echo, The Lancet, founded in 1823, is a prestigious English medical journal, as well as the instrument used to open the veins of 19th-century English patients and bleed them in order to rebalance their humors. The theory of the humors led to spectacular misconduct, including the use of leeches and bloodletting, and to unnecessary death. These ideas were not just damaging and sometimes fatal to individual patients. They placed major intellectual obstacles in the way of important progress. Wooten makes the point that the microscope, the technology necessary to discover penicillin, was available 2 centuries before a laboratory accident revealed that an extract of Penicillium notatum mold could kill bacteria. Perhaps the question is not how Alexander Fleming managed to discover it in 1828, but what took the medical industry so long? What we need in such cases as these is a history, not of progress, but of delay, not of events, but of non-events, not of an inflexible logic, but of a sloppy logic. Wooten writes, "And these cases, it turns out, are in medicine, at least until very recently, the norm, not the exceptions. In all these mystical doctrines, from witch doctors' incantations, to balancing of the humors, to Paracelsus's hodgepodge, mercury's ability to produce a readily and rapidly observable physiological response made it an essential part of the medical toolkit for centuries. Mercury was also tailor-made to balance the humors. It caused a number of medically satisfying physiological effects. The disgorging of pints of saliva, the immediate loosening of the bowels, even the vomiting of last night's dinner as an emetic. And for anxious mothers, it could speed the pace of dentition in infants by loosening the gums." While mercuric chloride was used in treating syphilis and preventing bacterial infection in the operating room and the household, for everyday medical applications, and in the early days of the pharmaceutical industry, mercuric chloride's chemical cousin, calomel, was by far the most commonly used. Calomel was believed to be gentler than mercuric chloride and was known by such names as Mercurius dulcis, or beautiful black, supposedly in honor of a black assistant who helped compound the original formulation. But calomel was toxic, too. Look what happened to Elizabeth Story when she was treated for a minor ailment at age 4, and her teeth fell out, and her jaw fused. To the Wolfman, when a doctor gave it to him for diarrhea, and it stopped his bowels from moving altogether. Such side effects were acknowledged, but considered by doctors a price worth paying for what they believed to be a virtual cure-all. Besides, successive generations of doctors saw themselves as improving on their predecessors' crude use of mercury, refining the dose, the compound, and the usage in ways that made mercury, in their hands at least, more helpful than harmful. In 1860, Dr. Alfred Still wrote Therapeutics and Materia Medica, a systematic treatise on the action and use of medical agents, including their description and history. In it, he aggressively advocated the use of mercury in medicine, though this didn't prevent him from working his way through a catalog of its horrors. Numbering them as he went, Still sounds a bit like one of today's TV commercials, reeling off the dangers of the drug it is pitching. 1. Mercurial fever. 2. Morbid action on the skin. The continued use of mercurial frictions irritates the skin, inducing at first redness or tenderness, and afterwards, in some cases, a peculiar eruption, erysipelas, or even fatal gangrene. 3. Ulceration. 4. Salivation. 5. Mercurial purging. Evacuations become at first feculent, thin, and greenish, and afterwards watery or frothy, and pale in color. There may be 10 or 15 such stools in the course of 24 hours. 6. Affections of the bones. 7. Affections of the nervous system. The neurological and psychiatric details of number 7 will by now be familiar. Pains in the head and limbs. In other cases, the senses are morbidly excited and the perceptions are perverted. A moody melancholy and fear of death may overtake the patient, who may sink into dementia, or more rarely, insanity of a maniacal form may be developed. In a few cases, epilepsy results. The trembling palsy due to mercury has already been described. In connection with or independently of it, paralysis may affect the limbs, involving only the upper or the lower limbs, or both at once. The same affection sometimes involves the laryngeal muscles, producing aphonia, inability to speak. Despite all this, over a period of about 5 centuries, some of the most prominent doctors in the major European medical centers were also the most fervent mercury advocates. Paracelsus elevated the element to his tria prima of mercury, sulfur, and salt. Van Swieten perfected its internal use against syphilis. Thomas Sydenham, who has often been described as the English Hippocrates, was a famous advocate of humoral practice who recommended purges with calomel as a necessary accompaniment to vigorous bloodletting. But while Sydenham favored the use of mercury, his primary treatment focus lay elsewhere. Most of his disciples, however, followed up on his treatment principles with more aggressive approaches. The most notorious of these was Thomas Dover, who has earned his name in history through his exuberant advocacy of mercury treatment. He is the Quicksilver Doctor. Dover is one of the most flamboyant characters in the history of medicine. Born in 1660 and educated at Cambridge, he began practicing medicine in Bristol. He interrupted his career for a while to become a pirate, or, to use the term preferred by those who plied the trade, a privateer. But he soon returned to Bristol to resume his medical practice. There, in 1742, he wrote an influential book, The Ancient Physician's Legacy, a paean to the benefits of mercury in treating his patients' illnesses. Dover first used mercury therapy, oral doses of metallic mercury, the equivalent of making his patients drink from a thermometer, to treat hysteria. In his book, he advocated it for almost everything under the sun, including the treatment of intestinal infestation, scrofula, ulcers, intestinal obstruction, for which he recommends, you need to go no further for the cure of this fatal disease than take a pound or a pound and a half of crude mercury. Dover prescribed 2 pounds of oral quicksilver to a leading British actor, Barton Booth, in 1733, and he died a week later. An autopsy showed the intestines had turned black and were lined with mercury, the rectum so rotten and blackened with mercury that it broke like tinder under examination. The essence of Dover's fatal error was to conclude that because mercury did something, these patients' seeming improvement in response to treatment meant it was curative. Side effects like salivation that pointed to its dangers were mistakenly seen as proof of efficacy. Today, discussions of mercury and its effects tend to focus on precisely matching each specific type of mercury to a set of specific and distinctly different effects. However, rereading the history of mercury treatments reveals a different pattern. Across its wide range of uses, one generally also observes a wide range of adverse consequences, from vague neurological complaints, to irritability, to violent outbursts, to frank psychosis, from salivation and diarrhea to constipation, from bad teeth to loose gums to fused jaws, from constriction of the visual field to blindness, from tremors to palsy to death. Over centuries of misuse, wide variations in formulation have generated a wide variety of symptoms, symptoms disparate enough to generate consistent controversy over whether they resulted from mercury exposure or something else. Anyone who believes he or she has isolated mercury's specific effects and pinned each one on an exact dose of a particular formulation is merely channeling Thomas Dover, showing a naive and inadequately respectful grasp of the dangers of quicksilver and its progeny. In addition to the wide range of symptoms mercury could cause, there was also wide variation in susceptibility to its effects. But the reason for that was a mystery to Dover and his contemporaries, and remains so today. Still, writes, some persons are so very susceptible to it that even the least dose of a mercurial medicine will suffice to excite tialism, or salivation. On the other hand, numerous cases have occurred of persons who appear to be quite insusceptible. Making America sick. The use of calomel, purging, and other harmful practices reached a fevered pitch in the United States under the doctrine of heroic medicine, the American origins of which are most often attributed to the influential colonial physician Benjamin Rush. Heroic medicine aggressively upheld the theory of the humors and was notable in its focus on bloodletting, purging, and emetics. For the practitioners of this school, calomel was their drug of choice, and no one was a stronger advocate than Dr. Rush. Rush was indisputably brilliant and passionately persuasive. He amplified the ideas of English predecessors like Dover and Sydenham, which he picked up in his own medical education. Because there were no established medical schools in the colonies, Rush went to study in Edinburgh with William Cullen, an ambitious theorist and influential teacher. Cullen adopted a view of physical illness akin to Charcot's approach to hysteria, seeing illness as a disease of the nerves. From this followed the idea of depletion therapy, which incorporated bleeding, restricted diets, purging, and calomel. Rush was an enthusiastic believer in depletion therapy and came up with his own variation on Cullen's theories, seeing all illness as excessive tension caused by disturbances of the blood vessels. Reduce the tension, drain the swamp of fetid substances afflicting the body, and health would surely be restored. Not only was Rush a signer of the Declaration of Independence, he represented Philadelphia at the Continental Congress and soon became third in command of doctors in the Continental Army. A protege of Benjamin Franklin, he grew to wield enormous influence in the young country based on the strength of his intellect, personality, and medical connections. It was due largely to this influence that depletion therapy in general, and the use of bloodletting and calomel in particular, reached unprecedented and catastrophic levels in American medicine. Under his treatment, if 10 grains of calomel didn't work or even made the patient sicker, the solution was simple: a higher dosage given more frequently. The exact moment when this idea took hold of Rush is vividly described in his own words. Surrounded by disease and death during a yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia in 1793, Rush was desperate to find an effective treatment. He came across an old manuscript describing the yellow fever epidemic of 1741, given to him by his friend and mentor, Benjamin Franklin. He was struck by the comment that purging, expelling toxins via the bowels, is more necessary in this than in most other fevers. A new train of ideas suddenly broke in upon my mind. I adopted this theory in practice and resolved to follow them. The purgative therapy he adopted was calomel. In hospitals during the Revolutionary War, he had seen it given in 10-grain doses. Now, I resolved after mature deliberation to prescribe that purge. He gave one patient 20 grains of calomel at 2 doses, twice to 4 times as much as doctors were administering during the Revolutionary War 15 years earlier. They operated powerfully, upwards and downwards, and brought away a large quantity of bile. The effects of this medicine were such as I had wished. The next day he was out of danger. I prescribed the same medicine in many other cases with the same success. Success did have its side effects. Now and then a salivation continued for weeks and months after the crisis of this fever, to the great distress of the patient, an injury of the credit of mercury as a remedy in this disease. But Rush was not discouraged. He stepped up the dosage to 10 grains, 4 times a day. One patient got 150 grains of calomel over a 6-day period, and he concluded it worked, curing the first 4 out of 5 patients he tried it on. While mistaken, Rush's beliefs became self-reinforcing. Rush dismissed his critics with the true believer impatience shown by Dover, the Quicksilver Doctor, and many grateful yellow fever survivors backed him. "There can be no question," wrote Robert North, retired professor of medicine at the University of Texas, in his essay, "Benjamin Rush, M.D., Assassin or Beloved Healer." that Rush's mercury purges and copious bloodletting were profoundly erroneous, and sometimes fatal. How many hundreds of deaths Rush watched during the yellow fever epidemic is not known, but in each case he found some way to exonerate his remedies as a cause. Many people that Rush should have respected, including most of his professional colleagues, pointed to their own observations that Rush's treatment was often worse than the disease and murderous in its consequences. Rush, however, answered to a higher authority. He truly believed, concluded North, that he had been chosen by God to save the people of Philadelphia, and that opposition to his views was heretical and sacrilegious. Rush's heroic model reached its peak during the Civil War and led to one of the greatest showdowns in American medical history. In 1863, U.S. Surgeon General William Hammond ordered that calomel and tartar emetic be taken off the approved list of medications for the Army. He had concluded calomel killed more patients than it helped, but this triggered a vehement response from the medical community that came to be known as the Calomel Rebellion. Union Army doctors, unwilling to concede their treatment was worse than none at all, prevailed on the Secretary of War, already at odds with Hammond, to remove him. Hammond would not go quietly, so he was court-martialed. Calomel continued to be poured into soldiers, suffering from everything from typhoid fever to constipation, and the medical conditions of Civil War troops on both sides of the battle were simply terrible. 400,000 of the 600,000 soldiers who died in the Civil War died from illness, not battlefield injury. While calomel was controversial on the battlefield, it was also ubiquitous in the general population. Americans consumed almost 14,000 pounds of it in a 12-month period in 1891 to 1892. In the last half of the 19th century, as nearly every American took mercury for one reason or another, some in copious amounts, a condition called neurasthenia was first identified. Often compared to hysteria, American nervousness, it was dubbed, neurasthenia comprised a cluster of physical symptoms that suggest a possible link to calomel. Neurasthenia was first identified in 1869 by George Miller Beard, a neurologist. One of the chief proponents of neurasthenia as a clinically distinct disease was Giles Weir Mitchell, a Civil War surgeon who suffered from the condition, likely from his constant exposure to mercury in medicine. The symptoms included pain or numbness in parts of the body, anxiety, fainting, headache, stomach problems, what was called hay fever, but now would probably be defined as allergy or asthma, and a bizarre affliction doctors called movable kidney. This probably reflected swelling or tenderness in the kidney, the body's main organ for detoxification, which led doctors to believe it had changed position. But the idea that neurasthenia resulted from a toxic exposure was never part of the discussion. It was believed to result from the increasing urbanization and frantic pace of the times. There is a large category of functional nervous disorders that are increasingly frequent among the indoor classes of civilized countries, Beard wrote in 1896, sounding like Emil Kraepelin discussing GPI in more advanced cultures. Neurasthenia is an American disease. Emphasis in original. In this, that it is very much more common here than in any other part of the civilized world. Neurasthenia, indeed, like the decay of the teeth, which in some cases is one of the symptoms of the neurasthenic tendency, was first made of special consequence in this country. But neurasthenia could have been an American disease because heroic medicine, with its gargantuan calomel purges, was an influential American movement. The condition was accompanied by another noteworthy symptom, sweating of the hands and feet, with redness. This phenomenon is certainly more common in males than in females. The milder phases are common enough, but there are severe manifestations that this syndrome may assume, which seem well nigh beyond belief, Thus, a young man now under my care is so distressed thereby that he threatens suicide unless he is permanently cured. Despite such severe physical symptoms, doctors defined and diagnosed neurasthenia as a symptom of urban life and stress, just as Freud and Breuer saw their patients as struggling with repressed emotions and unresolved childhood conflicts. Because neurasthenia, like hysteria, faded as a diagnosis in the early 20th century, today's historians of medicine and society have perceived it in much the same way, viewing the whole episode in terms of late 19th century social discourse, and missing the truth entirely. These patients were real people who were really sick. From Teething to Teens. In 1931, a French doctor, Charles Rocaz, published a book titled L'acrodynie enfantile, about a strange disorder afflicting children in increasing numbers. Although most recovered, many died. Official statistics reported a total of 33 deaths of children in England and Wales that year, an upward trend that started with one recorded death in 1923. The disorder's miseries became clear in the portrait of a 3.5-year-old child, whose decline is depicted in the book. The child had been sick for weeks, and while his parents treated him for worms, strange symptoms accompanied his illness. The hands and feet also became red, swollen, and moist. The child cried incessantly and was only pacified when allowed to rub his hands together vigorously. The child quit talking, tried to hit his parents, and battered himself against the bed. The parents sadly remarked that he resembled a raving lunatic. He quit eating, refused to stand, became more lethargic and apathetic, and had difficulty swallowing. 3 days after being taken home, he died. In the English translation of Rocas's book, the title was changed to the disorder's more familiar name, Pink disease. Pink disease is one of that group of diseases which appear intermittently in this world, Rocaz begins. Entering the realms of medical investigation afresh, they are apt to be signaled as new diseases, the knowledge gleaned by our forefathers having been forgotten. 2 decades later, when the cause of pink disease, mercury, the active ingredient in such popular childhood potions as teething powders, worm treatments, and diaper rinses, was finally detected by a scientist in Cincinnati, Rocaz would be proven wrong. Pink disease was not newly rediscovered. Pink disease was new. Once again, the remedy was the disease, and once again, the clues were there. The worm treatment likely contained calomel and caused the child's suffering and death. But for the first half of the century, doctors and scientists puzzled over this strange syndrome affecting infants. There is not even the consensus of opinion as to the best name for the malady, Rocaz wrote. Among them, erythroedema, Fears disease, Swift Fears disease, acroerythroedema, neurosis of the vegetative system, trophodermatoneurose, dermatopolyneuritis. Acrodynia, the medical term that stuck, literally means pain in the hands and feet. From the Greek, acro, for extremities, as in acrobats. Some of the first observations of the disease emerged in Australia around 1914. In 1920, a Melbourne doctor presented 91 cases in detail. One doctor suggested calling it raw beef hands and feet, while Dr. Chubb of Sydney offered a shorter and more palatable name, pink disease. At about the same time the physicians of North America announced the pink disease had appeared in their midst, Rocaz reports, this included 10 cases in Portland, Oregon, the first seen in 1914. It was also identified in the British Isles, Canada, and in parts of Europe. Although pink disease came to be named for its outward physical manifestations and misery, "My hands are on fire! My hands are on fire!" one child wailed, it was equally a neurological and psychiatric condition. Rocaz said nervous symptoms played the leading role in the entire course of the illness, The first reported effect was the loss of the usual gay and happy disposition. The child ceases to display any affection, and his favorite amusements lose their charm. The little patient conveys the impression of intense physical and mental suffering. At the same time, he ceases to speak. A gay and talkative child may be completely mute. Rokas goes on to describe even more extreme behaviors. These children were banging their heads against furniture, throwing themselves around at the risk of injury, tearing at their hair, and inflicting harm on themselves in any number of disturbing ways. What on earth was happening? While Rokas and others believed that better diagnosis was simply leading to the identification of more cases, many concluded it was too identifiable and bizarre to simply have escaped notice up until this point. Ideas of causation ran the gamut among medical professionals, including viruses, vitamin deficiency, exposures to toxins and poisons, or an allergic reaction. Some said it was psychosomatic, and some blamed parents. On May 29, 1948, a paper just over a page long appeared in The Lancet. Its authors were Joseph Warkany, an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Cincinnati, and Donald M. Hubbard, an assistant professor of industrial hygiene there. These were not major players on the world's acrodynia research scene. Hubbard was not even an MD. In that 1948 paper, Warkany and Hubbard describe how, in 1945, a child aged 14 months with severe acrodynia was brought to the Children's Hospital of Cincinnati. Running tests on a specimen of the child's urine, they discovered a high level of mercury, but said the source of mercury could not be established in that child. Soon, however, they had examined a total of 20 children with acrodynia and found high mercury levels in 18. As they attempted to determine the source of the mercury, the scientists found that the parents were not especially helpful. Most of them didn't know which medications or creams might have contained mercury. Still, Warkany and Hubbard persisted and established that calomel had been an ingredient in a variety of products used on these children, whether by way of ointments applied to the skin or the ingestion of teething powders. Ultimately, they identified multiple sources of mercury, about a third of them teething powders, including diaper rinses that use mercuric chloride, and in one case, possible exposure to thimerosal, a new mercury compound in medicine. The groundwork for this spectacular discovery was laid in the most prosaic way. Hubbard, the industrial hygiene researcher, had been working on technology that could detect minute amounts of mercury in urine, and in 1940 published a paper on a photometric method using a new reagent, dibeta-naphthylthiocarbazone. A follow-up paper in 1946, co-authored with Jacob Cholak, reported further refinement of the technique. After poring over endless papers about acrodynia, Rokas's runs to 123 pages, reading Warkany and Hubbard's short, matter-of-fact report on mercury excretion in acrodynia patients is bracing, like coming upon Einstein's brief 1905 paper on special relativity. No footnotes, because there were simply no antecedents. Technology and toxicology enabled the breakthrough. Warkany credits Cholak, the co-author of Hubbard's follow-up paper, with the suggestion that they look for a broad range of metals in the urine of the acrodynia patients. Warkany wrote follow-up papers in 1948 and 1951 that definitively linked mercury poisoning to acrodynia, and he began moving on to the next logical step, awareness of the etiological relationship between acrodynia and mercury points the way toward prevention. Teething powders, the most frequent cause of acrodynia in our series, are apparently completely useless and should be abandoned. One would think that might be the end of it, but Warkany and Hubbard did not receive instant acceptance of their discovery. In 1953, 5 years after their finding of high mercury levels in children with acrodynia, the Journal of Pediatrics ran an article by Donald Cheek of Australia, who was unwilling to concede that the mystery had been solved. It is sometimes dangerous to compare diseases of known etiology, such as mercury poisoning, with diseases of unknown origin. Although pink disease shows nearly all the features of mercury poisoning in its different phases, the same could be said of other agents. He persisted with the idea that family dynamics could play a role, referring to a 1952 paper that claimed a striking frequency of stressful family situations in these cases, often more evident than in families of children attending psychiatric facilities. One reason for the lingering debate over acrodynia was that although Warkany and Hubbard found high levels of mercury in nearly every acrodynia patient, they could find the source of the exposure in only about two-thirds of them. This does not suggest that a third of acrodynia cases were caused by something besides mercury. No one now disputes that mercury was the sole cause of acrodynia. Rather, it suggests how pervasive mercury compounds were through the first half of the 20th century in the United States, Great Britain, and Australia. It also signals the rise of a particularly modern institution, the first media-savvy pharmaceutical companies who transformed the ancient craft of the apothecary with modern advertising techniques. These entrepreneurial innovators turned a backroom chemistry trade into a branded consumer packaging business, offering treatments for everything from teething to constipation. These marketers grew prosperous through their skill in identifying profitable consumer markets and knowing how to make a sale. You'd have to be a bad mother if you didn't heed the call to use Steedman's Gentle Powders. While a number of companies peddled such products, Britain's John Steedman & Company was the biggest, and it pioneered the kind of ubiquitous marketing that has reached its apogee in today's glut of TV pharmaceutical ads. One example we encountered is a postcard of a shoe full of kids crediting a Mother Hubbard character who gave them all Steedmans from teething to teens. Adapting the timeless nursery rhyme the way current advertisements pick up classic rock songs. But why would all these children need Steedmans from infancy through the teen years? That is artfully explained in a palm-sized pamphlet with a sturdy laminated cover titled Hints to Mothers on the Treatment of Their Children from Teething to Teens. We found the undated 18th edition, suggesting a certain degree of popularity, in which was displayed a handy alphabetical list of the ailments to which children are prone, from abscess, adenoids, backwardness, and bedwetting, to warts, whooping cough, and worms. In this edition, teething is in the title to suggest infancy and the original use of the powder. But oddly, teething powders are not even mentioned. By this point, the firm's ambitions were much greater, and teething was merely a come-on. Echoing the superstitions observed by Canner, the pamphlet notes, "The period of dentition is the longest, the most difficult, and the most critical operation through which a child must pass." Teething may be accompanied by various rather alarming developments, such as child crowing, convulsions, etc., which are discussed under these headings. The general health of the child requires particular attention if these troubles are to be avoided. The bowels must be kept regular. For proper bowel regulation, the authors frequently urged use of a gentle aperient, meaning a laxative, and the phrase appears relentlessly in Steedman's promotions. So perhaps the true cause of the rise of acrodynia was not just calomel, which had been around for a long time, but the marketing campaign to suggest it for all kinds of purposes and to prey on the fears of nervous mothers. This was a pioneering practice that also involved newspaper advertising. It offered an authentic-sounding source of authority, but a fatally toxic product. As the economies of England, the United States, and Australia grew with mass transportation and sophisticated consumer marketing, mercury became big business and a leading product line for the nascent pharmaceutical industries. Companies like Merck sold arsenic and mercury compounds well into the 1940s, and a teething product that began in an apothecary shop morphed into a remedy recommended for anything that might ail someone. As Britain's Pharmaceutical Journal reported in November 1939, John Steedman was not only a good pharmacist, he also believed in bringing to the attention of the outside world the products of his pharmaceutical skill. The original Steedman was a founding member of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society of Great Britain, and his heirs married into another patent medicine marketer founding family, the Hanburys, whose company, after a series of mergers, evolved into GlaxoSmithKline, Britain's leading drug company. The Calomel Legacy. Today, the medical industry has set the Acrodynia episode aside, just as the contribution of Warkany and Hubbard to genuine medical progress is largely overlooked. There are a number of ways of being forgotten in science, Warkany's University of Cincinnati colleague, Harold Coulter, later wrote. If you discover how to prevent a disease so successfully that it disappears, and physicians do not remember it, and students are not taught it, who will recall the name of the person that caused it to vanish? But as with syphilis and hysteria, there are lessons from the age of Acrodynia that are crucial to absorb. Chief among them is that new technology was required to solve the Acrodynia puzzle. Mercury can be detected in urine, but it was only when new and more sophisticated technology arose in the 1940s that Warkany was able to consistently detect it at low levels in Acrodynia cases. Once again, two core problems, the latency of detecting exposures and individual variations in susceptibility to mercury's adverse effects, confounded the efforts of those trying to understand Acrodynia. It often set in weeks or months after parents first used teething powders, worm treatments, diaper rinses, or a gentle aperient. And only a small proportion of children who received these exposures actually developed Acrodynia, something on the order of 1 in 500. While some doctors continue to argue that children who succumbed to Acrodynia were simply the ones who got the most mercury, that's not what Warkany believed. The fact that after mercury medication, children may excrete mercury in the urine in appreciable amounts without developing Acrodynia suggests that an individual susceptibility to mercury intoxication exists in the children who develop Acrodynia. But children whose immune systems were weakened by viruses or bacteria may have been especially susceptible. Doctors noted that Acrodynia seemed to occur more frequently during and after epidemics of influenza. This might simply reflect confusion between the first signs of mercury poisoning and an apparent contagious illness. But it is worth considering in light of what we believe is a microbe-mercury connection in a variety of human disorders, most notably, general paralysis of the insane. Warkany and Hubbard's papers eventually won the day. Teething powders were banned. Acrodynia disappeared. Occasionally, the medical establishment refers to it, but the disorder is largely treated as an embarrassing episode of medical history to be swept under the rug. Today, mention Acrodynia to a medical student and he or she will probably give you a blank stare. But its legacy continues. A couple of decades after the high rates of Acrodynia deaths were noticed in London during the 1940s, urologists began to observe an unusual pattern in men presenting with blockages in their sperm ducts. When operating on a broader set of patients with these blockages, doctors saw a specific course of illness in a subset of them. In 1970, an English doctor named Donald Young specified the syndrome, in which the effects of the blockage were uniquely painful. In addition to problems with sperm flow, Young's syndrome cases had other unusual symptoms. Chronic sinus and bronchial problems led researchers to suspect some form of damage to the delicate filaments that line the surface of sperm ducts, nasal passages, and the lungs. Most notable for our purposes, doctors recognized a relatively frequent history of Acrodynia in their Young's patients. One study showed that a history of pink disease was unexpectedly common in Young's sufferers. But as the birth cohorts of boys treated with calomel began to decline, so did the incidence of Young's syndrome. The conclusion? The toxic effects of calomel treatment had left a longer legacy to the generation of boys who grew up with Steedman's soothing powders, a wider swath than just those who showed symptoms of acrodynia. In this case, the legacy was infertility. Only a tiny percentage of these men ever fathered a child. Young's syndrome disappeared along with acrodynia and household mercury products, but other diseases have been connected to calomel in more indirect ways. One link that made news in 2009 is Kawasaki disease, a diagnosis given for Jet Travolta, the autistic child of actors John Travolta and Kelly Preston, who died of a seizure. Kawasaki disease was first identified in Japan in 1967, where two notorious episodes of mercury poisoning took place, and where mercury fungicides were also ubiquitous. Mercury fungicides weren't banned in Japan until 1968. Kawasaki disease is mostly known for its effects on the heart, but its symptoms closely resemble acrodynia. In a Japanese search for cases of Kawasaki disease before Kawasaki, a group of pediatricians from Tokyo University Hospital reported that the first case might have been identified as fear disease, a synonym for acrodynia, in 1952. As with Warkany's findings in the urine of acrodynia cases, practicing clinicians have observed elevated levels of mercury in the urine of children diagnosed with Kawasaki disease. One study reported that six patients with diagnostic criteria for Kawasaki disease had abnormally high urinary excretions of mercury. There are numerous clinical similarities between acrodynia and Kawasaki disease, and the appearance of Kawasaki disease has been related, temporally and geographically, to environmental pollution with mercury. In 2008, an article noting the connections between Kawasaki disease, acrodynia, and mercury was published in the peer-reviewed journal Current Medicinal Chemistry. It noted the symptom overlap of bright red swollen hands, feet, painful itching, burning sensations. The authors concluded medical literature, epidemiological findings, and some case reports have suggested that mercury may play a pathogenic role. Several patients with Kawasaki's disease have presented with elevated urine mercury levels compared with matched controls. Most symptoms and diagnostic criteria which are seen in children with acrodynia are known to be caused by mercury. Since 1990, 88 cases of patients developing Kawasaki's disease some days after vaccination have been reported to the Centers for Disease Control, including 19% manifesting the same day. Despite the fact that one of the first recognized cases of Kawasaki disease may have had an acrodynia diagnosis, this disease does not seem to have disappeared in the same way as acrodynia and Young's syndrome. So, while the calomel legacy has faded in some conditions, in others, there may be other toxic agents that play a similar role to calomel in causing disease, and the impact is still being felt. Perhaps the most affecting evidence of calomel's tragic legacy comes from the testimony of those who suffered from pink disease and are now adults, many of whom still suffer from severe after effects. A high-profile survivor is Heather Teeler of Australia. She founded the Pink Disease Support Group in 1989. She describes her life today. In particular, I have a terrible sense of position of both my body and hands. For example, it takes me ages to line up a clothesline, the clothes, and the pegs to hang out clothes. I have to have a rope hanging down from the ceiling of my carport to be able to have a guide to park the car in the correct place. I am hopeless with any locks, catches, car seat catches, etc. I go to open a door but miss the catch by inches. I drift when walking and often bump into walls and doors. I cannot cope with verbal instructions at all and have to write everything down. This is known as thinking in pictures. Temple Grandin. Grandin is probably the most famous person in the world diagnosed with autism. Thinking in Pictures is the title of her best-known book. We've focused here on a handful of the most compelling and significant episodes of mercury's broader use in medicine, and especially on calomel, but these are likely just the tip of an iceberg. Below the surface are many more tragic medical and personal histories. While some are known or suspected, most are lost to history. The point Elizabeth Story emphasized when she wrote about her own case, to warn those in high power of the danger of doing injustice or injury to any. Acrodynia was the beginning of the end for calomel in medicine, which would soon give way to the carbon compounds of mercury. In fact, the cause of this illness was discovered almost simultaneously with the first application of penicillin, which ended the use of mercury to treat syphilis. Germ theory had killed off the philosophy of the humors that justified mercury's medicinal use. A new era of pharmacology was blossoming. If mercury killed children and was connected to GPI and could be replaced as an antiseptic, why use it? But at the same time, why make a fuss? After all, the movement from mercury to penicillin could be chalked up not to a revolution in medicine, but rather to the march of progress of the medical profession. But we'll give Werkeny, who solved the riddle of Acrodynia, the last word. The fact that generations of physicians before us were well acquainted with the wide spectrum of adverse reactions to mercury, whereas we were not, illustrates the dilemma. One can go forward, and yet go in circles.